Hello and good evening to everybody. My name is Kaya Sitole and I am your host for tonight's Twitter Space. Coalition governments have become a more prominent feature of our politics in recent years. There's been a much greater focus on them, and there have also been serious questions raised about their viability, their utility, and their implications for service delivery. We do know that in the 2021 local government elections, many more of the prominent metros found themselves having to deal with coalition governments. Coalition governments have, of course, been a feature of our politics since as far back as 2006, but we haven't seen them as being as topical as they are now. What exactly is the reason behind that, and what exactly does it mean for you and I as the voters? We've got a national election next year in 2024. Does it actually link the national government election and local government elections and coalitions? Do they make a difference to the way in which you are now going to vote? That's what we'd like to deliberate on over the course of the next hour. And the topic for our conversation today is really the impact of coalition governments on service delivery in South Africa. We obviously would like to hear from you. So if you're able to tweet or X or whatever you call it when you do respond to this, feel free to do so. You'll also be able to raise your hand so that we can add you as a speaker, because obviously, like to hear your perspectives about what you've seen in the communities where you're based, and whether indeed what you've seen over the past couple of years or even longer does indeed influence your voting patterns, and more importantly, whether what you see in the local government arena translates into what you do in the national ballot and the provincial ballots that you'll be exercising next year. So that's really what we want to be able to focus on for the next hour or so. I will be joined by a panel of speakers who've got particular insights to share about how these things work and how these things don't work, and also some perspectives on what can be done differently going forward. One of my speakers is going to be Mzwanele Maekiso, who is the owner and publisher of Ndebua Journal. He's also the CEO of Ikwezi Institute. He's a prolific writer who has contributed to papers, think pieces, and academic journals and newspapers locally and internationally. So he has some very, very important and diverse perspectives on what actually needs to be ventilated in relation to the question of coalition conversations in South Africa. We'll also be joined by Tessa Dooms, who's a trustee actually of the Kagiso Trust and also happens to be a director of programs at the Rivonia Circle. She is indeed a democracy governance policy expert who's been inspired by the values of participation, social justice, and human-centered design. And all of you would have probably seen her in many spaces engaging on many issues relating to public policy and public policy making. Our last panelist for the evening is going to be Paul Smith, who is currently serving as the executive head of local governance support within the Kagiso Trust. His role there is to innovate new approaches to local government sustainability to enable stakeholders to find effective solutions that impact communities. And he's also been part of our previous Twitter spaces, where we've really been focusing on the question of active citizenry and what Kagiso Trust believes needs to be done, and more importantly, what you can do in order to get us there. So, of course, as I said, we'd like to hear from you. So please feel free to tweet about this conversation, reply to this particular page, the Kagiso Trust page, so we can be able to pick up your comments. And if you'd like to raise your hand, please feel free to do so. And then we'll simply elevate you to the role of the speaker, so then you can join in this conversation. My name is Kaya Sitole. I'm going to be the host for the next hour. And I'd like to start with you, Tessa. I mean, 2021 November seems to have been the watershed moment where a lot of people became aware of just how endemic coalition structures and coalition governments are in our body politic. Perhaps up until then, it was really a question of in 2016, City of Joburg, yes, and then that was obviously the big one. But in 2021, it became clear that many more of the prominent metros, many more of the prominent political voting areas are going to be subject to coalition governments. Is this a good development, or is this something that we should all be saying, wait, hold on, let's make a decision one way or another? It's untenable to have so many people saying that they're in charge.
Hi, Kaya, and thank you for the opportunity. So, good or bad is not where I'd like to talk about coalitions, because that makes it seem like it's an outcome that you can pursue. What coalitions are a natural outcome of elections, especially under the kind of electoral regime that we have. A PR, a representative system like the ones that we have, where political parties contest and proportionally get seats, would actually more frequently than not lead to coalitions. And so, even at local government level, where we have ward councillors on one of our ballots that are directly elected. We do still have the proportional representation system at that level. And so it should be expected that you're going to have a sharing of power. We are a multi-party democracy. We are not a two-state democracy with different or two-party democracy. We're definitely not a one-party democracy. And so we need to get comfortable with the idea that we have created a context for the sharing of power as our default for the way in which we want to govern. Now, the fact that one political party has had an overwhelming dominance is actually the anomaly. That's actually the thing that is strange, given the kind of system that we have. So we should have expected that we would get here at some point, a more shared and diverse governance space. Our parliament has always been this way. I think somebody noted that at the beginning of our democracy in 1994 already, we had more than 10 parties in parliament. So we've always had a shared democratic space in our parliamentary system, and now it's starting to be seen in the governance space. So it's not something that we should be concerned about. I think that would be the first response for me. But the second thing is, I think it does speak to a robust democracy. I've started saying in the last few days, as a way to crystallize my thoughts around, you know, where we're going wrong with our democracy, is that a democracy is about the people shall govern, not the government shall govern. And so by that, I really mean that we have this very, you know, narrow fixation on, you know, especially a president and particular individuals, whereas democracy should be about as many people participating in governance as possible. So even just the cabinet and cabinet positions isn't where all power for governance lies. So again, I say all of that to say that I don't think that there's anything to be alarmed about just in terms of coalitions. I think it's a good sign in a democracy for as many voices to be represented. And now we have the job of making this democracy work in as full a way as possible.
So Tessa, when people react to coalitions in these days, it's really from a point of frustration and a point of skepticism about the multiple shuffles and the instability that we see here. Is this really us perhaps not being well-tuned to the idea of political shifts and political reconfigurations? Or is this something that says, wait, hold on, we may accept the idea that coalitions exist, but we are a bit more concerned about how unstable these ones are?
Yeah, I mean, the instability is definitely a problem, right? And I think for me, there are two reasons why the instability exists. And I'm sure we'll get into this a lot more as we go down the line of the conversation. But the first reason is really the quality of our politicians is now shown up a lot more. I don't think we've cared enough about the qualities of our particular representatives and the qualities that we want in the people who lead enough. In a party system like ours, we've given a lot of primacy to the party. And so the party brand, for example, is a lot of the reason why people vote. And we're not looking at the qualities and the characteristics of the actual decision makers that are sitting at those tables. And so I think that is being shown up because it's not the brand that is going to actually make governance decisions or vote in council. It is actual individuals who do that. And I don't think we've paid enough attention and asked ourselves as a country and as voters, what kind of people do we want to see sitting behind those desks in a council or in parliament, making those kind of voting decisions? And we find ourselves in a situation where we have politicians who seem to be very fickle and who seem to not think much about, you know, holding council meetings that don't actually hold or making decisions without consulting constituents. And that's starting to show itself up in our politics. But the second one, and I think this is an important one for us to discuss in a lot of detail tonight, is the politicization of the administration and the bureaucracy in our country. Because it should be possible, and we see it in other parts of the country, in the parts of the world. I believe you're in the UK at the moment. I mean, last year, the United Kingdom saw three prime ministers in 4 months, and the bureaucracy could withstand that because the bureaucracy and administration should not be so easily affected in terms of service delivery by changes in politics. So if the politicians are fickle, the bureaucracy needs to be strong. And I think that we are finding that our bureaucracy is way too dependent on who's in power on any given day. And that's causing more instability than anything else.
Yeah, definitely not a tenable situation. Zanele, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. I mean, we now know that coalitions are an endemic part of our body politic, particularly local government level. There are now suspicions that we may actually need to start tolerating or living with them even at national government level. From an academic and a researcher like yours, when people start engaging on the question of, wait, hold on, these things, the way we've seen them associated with instability, surely it's not desirable to have them at the national level because nothing will ever happen. What are your reflections on that particular narrative? Is this really us condemning ourselves to political paralysis, or is it simply a matter of, well, the examples we focused on are the worst of what may actually still be a rather broad spectrum of possibilities?
Kaya, I think Zolele dropped off. He might have a network issue.
Yo, Eskom and the things it does. Okay, no, that's fine. Paul, I'll move on to you now while we still try to get Zanella back. I mean, as in the work that you've done, you've obviously engaged a lot with local communities and local governance structures. One thing that obviously is of particular interest to a lot of us is the question of those interplays and those intersections between, you know, what happens in a council chamber, where the politicians happen to be, what happens in the administration, where the things are supposed to work, and what happens at the coalface of service delivery. Can you just talk us through the interaction between the councillors at a council chamber versus maybe the entities that fall under that municipality and the bureaucrats that actually have to do the work?
Yeah, thank you, Kaya. First of all, I want to just agree with Tessa that coalitions are a thing for the future. We better get used to them. We've done a number of visits to, or most of the municipalities we work with are those that are underperforming, but we have spent some time lately with municipalities that are performing. And what we have found is that the relationship between the council and the municipalities, and Tessa iterated mentioned this in her opening statement, is very clear. People adopt the legislative roles and responsibilities and apply them to the letter. And so we end up with administrations that are not influenced by politics. And in most of these cases, we find, and I must say also that the success and failure of municipalities isn't really more about coalitions or majority parties, because there's successes and failures in both. But those municipalities that are being successful, we find that there's very strong municipal managers, and they've been given the agency to run the institution without political interference, and councillors hold themselves accountable. But even in those coalitions that are working, we've found that they're on a knife edge, because they're one vote away from chaos. And because the coalitions control the mayoral committees who engage with the administrators around certain portfolios and departments. So it's really important for councillors and administrators to understand their roles and responsibilities and stay in their channel. And it's very important to have a very strong municipal manager to manage the administration. And that's what the people feel in the streets. They feel service delivery issues, and where municipal managers are catered to deployed or incompetent, we see that there's more political influence in the administration, which leads to chaos. The other thing about the administrations, we've noticed that when a municipal manager is in charge and held accountable and there's good oversight from councils, we find that they tend to seek out competent and head out competent people to run the various departments with the right skills and capabilities to deliver the services that people require. So successful municipalities, very clear roles, application of roles and responsibilities, and strong administrations, administrations that can withhold the political instability if there is any to come. Thanks.
Now, Paul, one of the questions that has emerged is a simple question of whether there's actually a a structure that defines how these things ought to work. Now, one would imagine that at the point in time when the rules and the guidelines for even, you know, this three-tier structure of government are put together, somebody would have envisaged that, well, at some point in time, you may not have one party in absolute control. So therefore, how does the collaboration and the cooperative governance model work? Do we actually have rules that say, look, this is how things are supposed to be? And if we do have the rules, is it simply a matter of the parties that have been lucky enough to be in control of these municipalities have simply then, repurposed it to fit their narrative? Surely somebody must have written the rules, and we shouldn't be talking about how things ought to happen. We should know how things must be happening.
Yeah, Kai, that's a very important point. There are rules, and I think the rules, as far as we understand them, are reasonably sufficient at the moment. But I think we must also understand that we have a people problem. When we elect people into office at various elections, we really don't understand the intention of those candidates. And if people have ill intent, it doesn't matter what rules exist, rules will be broken. There's also legislation that governs the quality and type of person that should be employed in administration. But we're seeing more and more, as political interference affects the performance of local government, that the wrong people are put in the wrong posts. And so the administration become the puppets of the politicians, and that's a recipe for failure, I'm afraid. But I don't think we need to concentrate too much on there may be gaps in the rules and gaps in policy, but I think essentially we've got a people problem, and more importantly, we've got a leadership problem. We have to start thinking about voting people with the right intention into power that are community centric and focus on servicing and responding to the needs of community, as opposed to serving political masters or parties or anybody else up the value chain. And let's be clear on this. I think this type of interference is not only from a political perspective, but it also comes from civil society and the private sector, where people leverage off these types of relationships. And that's not good for communities.
Tessa, you know, when we talk about the structural configuration of all of this, I'm intrigued to sort of try and establish that, well, politically, if I become the mayor of the city of Johannesburg tomorrow, the first thing that I expect to get is my own team, my own mayoral committee, the people that I want. So naturally, it is inevitable that I'm going to replace all the incumbents because, well, we've just defeated them in an election. Now, is that a model that is unavoidable, or should there be a way that says, wait, hold on, all we did was change the mayor, who's a figurehead. Surely the MMC for finance was doing well, regardless of where they came from, they should retain their job? Or is that particular relationship purely a political one, so therefore there's absolutely nothing that can be said except that, well, every mayor gets the team of his choice?
Yeah, I think there are two layers to that. So I think the mayoral team, in terms of, you know, the MMCs, is highly political. And I think that there's more to be said about the political nature of that team. But I also think that what it means to be political at that level doesn't have to be about one's own party only. And this is whether you have a coalition government or not, right? So I make the example, in the 1994, when it was agreed upon for a government of national unity, even when the ANC won outright. So in order to strike a political agreement that made it easy for governance to happen, the ANC agreed to share the cabinet posts with other political parties on the basis of striking the right kinds of power balances. So there are different ways to construct the right kind of political arrangement other than just getting people from your political party. The second layer I wanted to mention, just before I speak about KZN, because I think Etiquini also has got an interesting story to tell, but who the mayor has in their mayoral office, so the staff team, that we must also remember is different from the bureaucracy. So the main bureaucracy from your head of department, your HOD downwards, and I say downwards in a loose term, that is the main bureaucracy of people who are who get their jobs through an appointment through the state, right? But people who are politically appointed within the mayor's office or within the MMC's office, those people more closely need to follow the mayor's directive in terms of their political intention, but also have to have some merit in terms of the work that they can do. So there are a lot of delegate balances, but I think there are different ways to make those right or wrong political choices. So Itakwini has are following an executive model where people are getting posts within or get selected into the mayoral committee, not purely just through the will of the mayor. And I think that that's also something worth exploring. Is there a way for us to think about the number of votes that a party gets, giving them access to a governance structure that is shared? I think that that in itself as a model does have merit for avoiding some of the things we've seen in the city of Joburg, where deal-making seems to be more prevalent than the will of the people. So again, I think there are different iterations around how you get to the right political mix, but it certainly doesn't just have to be from one's own party. And I actually think that the more diverse the governance group is, the better it is for governance, and less chances you have of kind of patronage setting in.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of points to be pondered on then. If you've just joined us, we are discussing the impact of coalition governments on service delivery. I've got Tessa Dwons and Paul Smith joining me here from the Kagiso Trust. We'd also obviously like to hear from you. I can already see some of your comments that have come through on our Twitter page, which is Kagiso Trust. But also, if you'd like to raise your hand and express your voice and sentiments here, feel free to do so. And then we'll aid you here as a speaker. Now, Paul, you know, when we now reflect on the system as it is, I do have to try and explore the question of what exactly is, you know, the domino effect of all these changes. Is it really a case that whenever a particular party says, look, we've lost faith in this particular structure, we want to vote in a new mayor, that immediately then obviously triggers a change in maybe the mayoral committee, maybe Durban being the exception of that? And does that then immediately translate to a paralysis in the type of work that gets done at the coalface level? Talk us through the domino effect of all these changes, or even if there is, or if there is even a domino effect at all.
Yeah, Kai, there's only one, there is a domino effect, and only in the cases where I think the administration is dominated or influenced by politics and the council. There are instances that we've seen changes and the administration hasn't been affected because the administrative system is robust enough with enough quality people in it to resist the disruption at a political level. I think it's interesting to note, and I just want to pick up on a point that Tessa raised, in all the municipalities that we've seen, and many of those are, in fact, coalitions, governments at a council level, we've only come across one mayoral committee that is a coalition, a multi-party mayoral committee. And Tessa alluded to that was the case in government in 1994. And that, interesting enough, when we quizzed the mayoral committee about the stability, obviously it was, and in most municipalities, political stability is really, really important because most municipalities, politics dominate the administration and influence service delivery. But in this particular case, the political stability was on a knife edge, and all because there was one vote. And so the success of the coalition was based on the fact that they could get enough votes together to dominate the balance of the council to form a coalition mayoral committee. And for me, that's still quite a weak predicament because half the council or 50 plus 1% of the council were in a stable coalition, which were holding the administration to together and supporting the administration. But the remainder of the councillors were still being disruptive in terms of rendering the town reasonably ungovernable at times. And for me, that is when we have to really think about electing people, when we're electing people, to consider the moral fiber of the individuals that we elect. Because I think one of our problems is that politics and municipalities is a career, and for many councillors in a municipality, this is potentially the only job that's available. It's either being a councillor or maybe it's nothing because of the high levels of unemployment. And so it makes it a really rigorous contest to who gets those positions. And we've seen extreme examples of how contested this space can be from time to time. So for many politicians, rendering a town ungovernable is part of their daily work. And so we really got to start thinking about who we protect. And the second thing I want to raise is, so what do we do so we can go out there and vote with a bit more interrogation of the people we vote for? But I think we also need to think about what we do in municipalities where coalitions are not working and municipalities are not delivering services. And I think we've got to start building civic coalitions and putting the strength back in the hands of people to start affecting local politics. I don't see any other way out of this. And it doesn't mean working against local government. It means working with local government, but playing a rightful role of a community in the local governance environment and influencing government to be more community centric. So yes, I mean, that's a long answer to your question, but where administration is dominated by politics, they will certainly be influenced by the change in mayor or in political parties in that municipality.
No, thank you for that, Paul. I mean, you mentioned one particularly troubling aspect of some people essentially, operating to collapse the structure because they're on the wrong side of the political divide. But I'd imagine that all of these people are firstly individuals. So how does it benefit them when service delivery doesn't happen in the communities that we have to assume they live in by virtue of the fact that they've been appointed as elected representatives for that community? That doesn't make sense.
Well, so if you, with being in control of a municipality, gives you access to lots of opportunity to influence procurement and do a number of things that maybe you shouldn't do. And it means sort of cementing your place for the next 5 years and at least you got a front seat to the feeding trough. And so it becomes really important. So those coalitions, I mean, remember that the parties that are not part of the major coalition or the individuals that are not part of the major coalition are generally part of another coalition. So in the case I'm referring to, 50 plus one are controlling the council, but 49% of the vote are not, and they form a separate coalition that could be disruptive. And so the municipality and the people on the mayoral committee and the portfolio heads are under constant confrontation from individuals and parts of the community, which is their constituency, to render the municipality reasonably ungovernable. And so these coalitions are sitting on a knife edge.
No, thank you for that, Paul. And listeners, if you'd like to raise your hand, please do let us know. We're also seeing some of your comments. I'm going to come to them now. Tessa, I mean, I want to ask this in a very twisted way. So I imagine that when we talk about national government, that's where policies to be formulated. It's important for us to avoid a paralysis there. But at local government level, surely once a budget has been passed for the financial year, whether it's be the 1st of April, whether it's the 1st of July, that budget is then binding on the administration and on the bureaucrats. Why should it then matter that 2 weeks later at the council chamber, there was a change in leadership? Does it simply mean that those that have been given the task to execute on that particular municipality's program of action for the year simply say, wait, hold on, this was on the back of a particular political instruction. That instruction is no longer there, so therefore we're not doing anything. What actually happens practically when we see all these shuffles?
That's a really great question, Kaya, and I'm glad you raised it that way. Because the passing of a budget is a matter of line items. The implementation of a budget is a matter of political will and political oversight. And there's two levels of oversight here. So the politicians, actually all the politicians, whether they're in council or in parliament or in legislatures, provincial legislatures, or they're in cabinet, or they're in the mayoral council. The job of the politician is to act as an activist on behalf of society. So here's the policy, and here's the program of action, and here's the budget. The administrators, it is their job to do that, but the politician must have oversight over that and make sure that it gets done, that the work gets done, and it gets done properly, and it gets done in the interest of the people. And that we as the people can go to them and say, hey, listen, actually, we need this other thing also to be done. Is there a way that that can be done now? Because the budget item, you know, says water pipes for this street, but now something has burst on that side. What must happen? And so the politician has the ability to then go and advocate and be an activist in that space for when things need to change, for when things are not being done that have been set out to be done. And I don't think we've thought about politicians in that way. We've really thought about politicians either as the be-all and end-all of whether things happen. So, you know, as almost the lords and saviors. Or we've thought about them as they have no control over anything. It's the bureaucrat's fault. And I think it's something in between. It's that the politician needs to be agile enough and responsive enough to the community and those who they represent to be able to go and be the advocate on their behalf to make sure things happen. And I think the accountability level that I personally think we don't talk enough about is the accountability between council and the mayoral committee and the mayor. Because as much as it's the job of the mayor and the mayoral committee to make sure the administration do their job, it is the job of the councillors to make sure the mayoral committee does its job. And that is not the dynamic we see. The dynamic we see is the mayor and the mayoral committee are voted in, and all of a sudden, they become the most important politicians in the room. They become the politicians who can make or break everything. And by law, by constitution, the council is supposed to be able to keep the mayoral committee and the executive to account. The dynamic should actually go in the other direction. The mayor and the mayoral committee should be afraid of council, not council should be taking instructions from the mayor and the mayoral committee. We see this at parliament as well. All of a sudden, the president is seen as a higher ranking political figure than the parliamentarians that are supposed to keep him accountable, him or her accountable. That dynamics is something we have to change. But the only way to change it is the other level of accountability that Paul has raised so well. The level of the citizen and the community and civil society and people outside of the politics and their ability to keep the politicians accountable. At this point in our country, we simply have way too few mechanisms for us as the voter or as the resident and the citizen and the one who's supposed to be represented by the politicians to make sure that they do things the right and proper way. At local government level, it is our best opportunity to do it, I argue, because we have ward councillors, as you rightfully said, who are voted in to be representatives of their ward. They should be staying in that ward. They should be accessible to people in that ward. We allow people who are ward councillors directly elected by the ward to be more responsive to their political parties, if they have them, than to us as the residents and the citizens. And we have no mechanism of holding them accountable. I mean, in other countries, you have a recall clause where you can actually recall people who you've put into power. We can't recall political parties on the PR list. We can't even recall people who are ward councillors who we directly elect. The problem in our system overall is accountability at every level, and we have to fix that if we are going to make any way with governance in general, but particularly with coalitions.
Clearly, a lot of work still needs to be done. We've got a couple of speakers who raised their hands. Joseph, I'd like to start with you, if you can speak, please.
Thank you so much, Kaya. The first and foremost thing that I would like to highlight is when you do a coalition, I would present to you a case study of the Modimolle Mogopo municipality, whereby the Freedom Front Plus and the EFF went into a coalition. When they went into a coalition, they both had their political mandates that they needed to fulfill as parties. And when they had that, and the unfortunate part was that the MM, the municipal manager by that time, was a deployee that was hired by the ANC. So now when they tried to do the change, or when they tried to do service delivery there, the municipal manager was the person that was sabotaging them. And then they also had some of the PR councillors that when they went into council, they went against the so-called leading party or the ruling party of the municipality. The other thing is that when we come to ward councillors, some of the ward councillors wouldn't even go and do the mandate of the organization as they were chosen. And then after that, there will be a hindrance on the service delivery and the IDPs of that certain ward. But then the problem is that we cannot afford to recall them, because of when you recall the ward councillors, you go into by-elections. And there is a problem that if you go to by-elections, you might even lose the by-elections. So when you try to hold people accountable in municipalities for service delivery, we should also look at the fact of holding the municipal managers also accountable, because they are the actual administrative heads of municipalities, and they are the ones that actually would account, rather than the political heads would be your mayor, your speaker, and your chief whips. The other problem that they would be facing as coalition municipalities is that you find that the MEC of Cokster or Cokter in that province, when they do not agree with you, they would put that municipality under Section 101B, which is under administration. They would put their own administrator there, and then they would tell the administrator to pursue their own agendas. That's what was happening in Mogalakwena, and it also happened in the Modimolle Mogopo municipality, whereby when the Freedom Front Plus and the EFF went to have a robust and a fruitful coalition there, the ANC would disrupt their coalition. And then they would have their councillors to go and disrupt council. So nothing would be adopted. So it would hinder, even if they had a budget and then they had plans for the budget to implement such and such service deliveries, it wouldn't be foreseen because of the disruptions coming from COCTA with the administrator, and also the disruptions coming from the councillors and the PR councillors. So the other thing that civil society needs to do is that they need to engage with the municipal managers. They need to engage with the provincial COCTA or COCSTA offices and tell them this is what we need as residents of a particular town also. Because it's simply a bit difficult, because when we go there, even with the staff that being hired in the office of the mayor and the office of the speaker, they all come there with political mandate. And then with parties like the EFF, if you don't do that, they would recall you. With parties like the Freedom Front Plus, they would be a bit more on an academic side and look out for other solutions on how to implement. But then to implement your policies is generally difficult because of the situation that one would be facing. I think I'll just pause there.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you very much, Joseph. You've definitely showed a lot of insights, and I think you've clearly kept your finger on the pulse of the developments in local government. So you've given us a very important case study there. Mzwanele, I can see that you've finally been able to get onto speaker level. Your reflections on what we've heard since the beginning of the hour from Tessa, Paul, and now from Joseph? Mzwanele, if you are speaking, we cannot hear you. Please unmute yourself. All right. I think we are struggling to get hold of Mzwanele now. We're going to come back to you, Tessa. Tessa, I'd like to sort of figure out, well, what do we do next? Because clearly, we now have seen how the system has worked and what the limitations are in relation to that system. Do we need to write new rules, or do we simply have to hope that the political system organically evolves and starts sorting out these things?
Sure. That second one is just a no-go. We can't hope. Hope is not a plan. So for me, there's two things. One is around the rewriting of the rules and the regulations and the laws. So I hear Paul saying, you know, that we already have systems in place. But I don't think that our constitution has made enough room for, and our laws at this point, for really managing coalitions more effectively. So if you take into account what Joseph is saying, you know, in that very practical sense, who is responsible for making sure that a coalition agreement is abided by? You know, is there legal recourse if a party's coalition agreement or people in that within those parties defy those coalition agreements? Right now, there isn't. In a country like Sweden, it is actually at national level where they've had coalitions now for decades. It is the job of the speaker to legally actually hold political parties accountable for their coalition agreements. So I don't think there's enough recourse that we have right now for people actually abiding by the coalition agreements that are set. The second thing is also how we formulate coalitions, right? So a few weeks ago, when the deputy president of the country called the coalitions in Daba, I'm not sure what it was called anymore, right? It was a long time ago. But when he called that forum for discussing frameworks for a coalition, the question of thresholds came up, and it was a very thorny issue around having a minimum threshold to be able to be part of a coalition government. But those are the kind of things you must thrash out. You must thrash out, are there ways to better organize coalitions, better determine them with as little interference as possible or not? And then the final thing that Joseph said that I think is also worth pointing to is that question of what happens with the administrators, somebody like the municipal manager. And what Joseph said is exactly what I meant by the depoliticization of the administration. And so the administrators, in effect, actually are the ones who you would hope would hold politicians more accountable to their coalition agreements. But if that administrator has their own political agenda, that becomes a huge problem in the system. And figuring that out is both the job of the politicians and the incumbent politicians of the day to be able to have checks and balances. If somebody is not performing, whether they're not performing because of their competence level or because of their political interference, the law must allow and protect the ability of the politician to be able to fire. On the other hand, the law must also protect a municipal manager from not being arbitrarily fired from a politician trying to settle political scores. So again, therein lies opportunities really for rules and regulations to be thrashed out properly. I'm not, and I say this with a bit of a giggle in my voice because I'm part of an organization that was party to a court case this week. So I say that knowing that. But I'm not a fan of us sorting out all of our political problems through legislation or through court processes. But I do believe that there is a role for a negotiation that is political, that is set in stone by law. And so there's a role for the law in this, but it does require as well mature and deep political engagement and conversation. I think the last thing that I do want to add, because I'm not sure if I'll speak again, is also that question of the quality of the politicians. Again, Joseph's story highlights that you need good quality politicians on either side who care enough about the people that even if they don't have the political power or the access to the fiscus, that they will see the benefit of service delivery regardless of who provides it. Somebody said a good idea doesn't care who does it. Toilets getting delivered to the community don't care who delivered them. Whether they are delivered by the FF Plus, the EFF, or the ANC, the toilets don't care, and neither do the people who get those toilets. And so we must start electing people who have that kind of ethic and who have the fundamental political skill to form coalitions. Coalescing is a very basic political skill. Politics is about negotiation and the ability to persuade. Coalitions require negotiation and persuasion rather than disruption. And I think that's one of the fundamental things that must change.
Tessa, the idea of a pact or an agreement amongst coalition parties It's a difficult one because obviously no party goes into an election saying, we know we're not going to win, but in case we get a vote or two, this is who we're going to partner with. We know parties don't do that. They all work on the politic hyperbole that they're going to win. So these political pacts that you would then sign up, what happens if a party comes in on the back of saying, look, we've got a particular strong position in XYZ and its political partners or prospective political partners are complete opposite of that? Does that not create a legitimacy crisis for the next electoral cycle where people say, wait, hold on, 5 years ago, you said you were on this ticket as soon as you got in there and power looked very close to you. You then decided to back a party that said that it doesn't do these things. I voted for you because you said otherwise. Why should I trust you again? Because you're selling my vote to the people whose ideology I'm completely opposed to. Isn't that the legitimacy crisis that they all face?
Yes, but the way you negotiate that has two components to it. One is that you need to go to your constituents, and you need to take your constituents along in the journey of that negotiation. And that requires the second thing, which is time. I always make the example about the last German election, right? In the last German election, it took over 6 months for the coalition parties to actually come up with a finalized coalition agreement. In that 6 months, the new elected government could not be the elected government. So you needed the bureaucracy to function in that 6 months without a legitimized political head. But the law allows for more than 6 months to form those coalition agreements so that you can get through that negotiation process, go back to your constituents, and get people onboarded. In our case, we have 2 weeks by law to form a government. That is hopelessly not enough time to get through the difficulties of the political negotiations you're talking about. Again, that's a regulatory issue that we can solve for that will help coalitions not only be more stable, but also overcome the hurdles of the legitimacy that they need to garner from their constituents. But I think it also raises another important point, that once we give our vote to people, we should not just give our vote and then walk away for 5 years and then see what happens. Number one, we should expect they're going to come back to us and give us a report back on their governance. We are hiring them. Nobody who hires waits for 5 years to see what happens at the end of what the employee does. Yet we're doing that with our vote. But the second thing that's important is that we must not take for granted that we can actually hold people to account in the way that you're talking about and say, what did you do with my vote? What are you doing with my vote? It should be an active thing that we do 365 days a year, not at the end of 5 years and then only have that conversation.
Paul, I have a question for you from Dipuo Tsabamodimo. Why is it that we can elect local government officials such as councillors, but we can't recall them as communities when we have a motion of no confidence against them? What exactly are the rules and guidelines around that? Because we hear parties want to table motions of no confidence against each other. Well, what happens when we as citizens don't have any confidence? Are we paralyzed?
Hi, Kaya. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear me, Kaya?
Yes, we can.
You can?
Yes, I can hear you. Please carry on.
Okay. You're speaking to Mayegi, so now.
Yes, carry on.
All right. Well, actually, the whole technology issue is a problem, but I'm glad I can talk now. Well, you see, my view is that perhaps I'm different from whoever has spoken before, because I think the whole concept of coalition governments is the actual crisis, you know, for South Africa. Because whilst, you know, they appear at face value to be, you know, a good thing, in reality and practically, they are actually destabilizing governance in South Africa. If one were to look at 2016, when this thing became a practical reality, there's been so much destabilization in governance, particularly in the major metros of South Africa. And I would further argue that whilst coalitions are a good thing in Europe, they may not be such a good thing for South Africa because, one, we are a developing country, and two, because of our economy, it's not as strong as the European economies, where you know those systems can withstand the collapse of governments in 3 months or 6 months, and so on and so on.
All right, and I think we've lost another speaker point. Paul, you can jump in.
We can still hear him, Kaya.
Okay. The other point I wanted to make is that when you look at South Africa today, we fought for freedom, and that freedom said one person, one vote. So if the ANC, the DA, and other parties go to the polls, let's take South Africa, for instance, the various governments. The ANC has had majorities in terms of the actual voting. But then that majority gets diluted when it goes to the chambers, because the ANC reaches less than 51%. But all in all, it's a majority party. So when I call it kind of elite pacting, when small parties come together to say, no, let's deny the ANC the ability to run a government. And whereas the ordinary South Africans have given a vote of confidence to this party, in this case, you can remove ANC and put DA. If the DA gets 48%, it seems to me that it should be able to run a government. But a party that has less than 1% gets to become a mayor of a major budget municipality like Johannesburg. And then attendant with that is the incapacity to deliver services properly because of the chaos that follows. Another example is Nelson Mandela Metro, where since 2016, that metro hasn't had any proper governing system. Because one party comes in for 3 months and then it kicks out, another party comes in, and so on and so on. My view is that since we fought for freedom under the banner that says one person, one vote, that shouldn't be taken away at the boardroom by political parties. It should actually be honest system where the people who vote are actually given the power to their party that they vote for, ANC or DA, to govern. Otherwise, we'll address this issue. Then I think the technical issues that are raised in terms of quality of representatives are genuine. The issue of bureaucracy, where you have incompetent people running, systems that they are not empowered to run. That is a major problem that affects governance in South Africa, and it should be addressed. That whole issue of political buddy-buddy system, it has to totally be addressed. But this one that says one person, one vote, it's actually an injustice when small parties come together to say we're kicking out the big party. After all, the central question, therefore, to the voter is, why should I care to vote for the ANC to give it 48% when a party that has 0% or 0.something% is going to go to meet with the DA and other parties to form a government against my vote? So I think there's a broader question there that we should be asking ourselves. Are we in a democracy or in something else? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. But just before I let Tessa in, one question I'd like to pose to you. I mean, when we say the will of the people, surely if the sum of everybody else who is not on the ANC ticket is 52%, that's more representative of the will of the people than the ANC's 48%. Why should that collective of 52% not be allowed to lead the government?
Well, I think for me, I would even leave the ANC name out and say if the DA gets, 58%, 48. The will of the people says that, for 48, the will of the people says my vote counts. And indeed, that's what I fought for, and it should count. So the 48%, if other parties get less than that, I should form a government, and I could even, you know, welcome other parties to assist me with governing. But it shouldn't be that small parties, 10 of them, they come together and cumulatively they score more than my 48%, then they form a government. I think it's an abrogation of my right, you know, to vote as a citizen, because nobody comes back to me to say, are you happy that we have voted, in fact, in the chamber, as now the elites, political, you know, participants, we've decided that it's not going to be the ANC or the DA, even if they got the majority vote. I think that's, for me, that's the key question.
All right. Tessa, would you like to respond to that before we close?
So, I mean, it's where I started at the beginning. So for me, coalitions aren't a good or a bad thing. They're an outcome of an election. And so there's no way to predetermine that we don't want coalitions. So that's the first thing I think we must all wrap our heads around, is that, you know, saying coalitions are good or bad, I don't think that that helps us much. Because in the same way that a coalition can be unstable, you can have a majority government. I mean, I was in Buffalo City Municipality this week, and I can tell you it's in tatters, and it's the only metro with a majority government, and it's not moving, and people are complaining about services not being delivered, even though there's tacit political stability. So the quality of governance isn't about whether there's a coalition or not. But the second point that I think is important is, I think Mzwanele is exactly right, is that every vote does count, right? So even the vote of the Al Jamaa voter that managed to have a mayor, even though they had very few seats, the beauty of democracy means that the Al Jamaa voters' vote counts. And like you rightfully pointed out, if the sum of, because what we do in our system is that we then put in place councillors who then vote for a mayor. If we wanted a first-past-the-post system, then what we should be doing is voting directly for a president or voting directly for a mayor. And that person then, as a first in a first-past-the-post system, then gets to constitute their government. And I mean, if we want that as a country, we can have that. But to say that it doesn't give us the value of our one man, one vote is untrue, when actually a coalition means that everybody's vote counts equally. And so if 52% of the population comes together through their representatives and they form a government, those votes count as much. And the ANC voters or the DA voters or whoever got the other 48% needed more votes. That's the way our democracy works.
Oh, thank you very much for that, Tessa. Paul, I want to come back to you now, because I think perhaps all of this wouldn't be an issue. It really will be a storm in a teacup if we could find a way of insulating service delivery, insulating, you know, the bureaucracy from all these changes. Is there a way for us to say, wait, hold on, it doesn't matter what happens in the council chamber, we are going to make sure that the clinic down the road still functions the day after, the school down the road can open the day after, regardless of who the mayor is or isn't? Is it possible for us to get there? Because if we can, I imagine all of this will just be a matter of political hysteria without the capacity to cripple service delivery.
Okay, I think, you know, just before I get to that, the reflection on coalitions or not coalitions, I agree with Tessa there. I think it's like the internet and the social media, the good and the bad and the ugly, it's here to stay. I think there might be a stronger tendency at smaller municipalities and smaller towns, maybe, and even some of the metros, maybe to start with a greater percentage of independent candidacy, because people maybe that are independent seem at the moment to be closer to constituencies. I think that's an important thing. But I think, and even with the debate around legislation to try and drive change, it's not that I don't think it's important to have the right rules in place. And Tessa eloquently put it that there are many options that we should look at changing whatever rules need to be changed. At the end of the day, if we continue to vote in people that are not ethical, and we must understand that the root cause of non-ethical behavior is intent. And so we have to start looking for people with the right intentions. And as communities, to stop the rot and to make the changes, We have to start building cohesive communities. We need to start building cohesive civil society, because it's at that stage, that's where local government and councillors get their agency from, and those communities need to take back their agency and provide significant oversight and hold councillors and officials accountable for what the community desires. And this is more than just engagement, it's collaboration. And so collaboration is co-creation, it's about ideation, co-ideation. It's not just about dissemination of information and supporting. So I think as communities, we need to start taking back our agencies, using our vote properly, and choosing people. And I suppose at municipalities with a proportional representative, it makes it difficult for us to have control over the whole situation. But I think if communities come together, local government has no option but to listen and start taking them seriously. But by communities coming together, I'm not talking about working against local government. I'm talking about working with local government. And we must also understand that the politicians we're electing at the moment, many of them don't have the capability to run probably in most small towns what is the biggest business in that town. And so we have to make sure, because of that, oversight is really difficult, and so they must use local community members with the right capability and capacity to support the council in applying oversight over the administration, and also supporting the administration to do the right work in the interest of community development, both socioeconomic development. So yes, can we stop this happening? Only if communities start burying their hatchets, coming together, co-creating, have a common purpose, and hold government to account. Thanks.
No, thank you very much for that, Paul. And I think obviously very important reflection. We're fast running out of time. And I'd like to give you the last word, Tessa. We're heading to national elections next year, 2024. Do we need to specifically identify parts of the system, whether it's legislative, whether it's procedural, that we need to tackle in order to avoid what we've seen at the local government, at these metros, becoming a national crisis? Or are we simply just overblowing it? There will be no crisis at all?
I think regardless of how the vote turns out next year, whether or not we end up with the need for coalitions, and I say need for because we could also have minority governments, right? Somebody can get 48% and no coalition forms that overtakes it, and they could govern. That being said, I do think the need for us to think through both political solutions and legal solutions is a good thing for us going into the future. I think it's a lacuna in our system, in our law, and our political culture. But I think something that Paul said earlier is much more important, that we must solve the people problem. We must get adults into the room who are going to focus on issue-driven and policy-driven coalitions rather than position-driven coalitions and deal-making coalitions. The quality of our politicians must be higher. And I think as we go into the 2024 elections, I would make coalitions an elections issue. I would ask political parties, what is your coalition strategy? Put it in your manifesto and commit to it. And let's talk about it before the election rather than afterwards.
A very important consideration there. And hopefully political parties are listening. Hopefully voters are listening. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to spend a special thank you to all of you who joined us for this particular conversation, and those of you who sent in comments and also participated in this. Also, my speakers, Mzwanele, Tessa, and Paul, for having given their inputs. My name is Cassie Tolle. Thank you very much. This has been the Kagiso Trust Active Citizenship Series, the impact of coalition governments on service delivery. See you next time. Have a wonderful evening.